Thank you. It's already made clear that in our department we have a certain preference for theoretical approaches to problems in neuroscience that can be tackled with methods of nonlinear dynamics, statistical physics. There is an echo somewhere, at least I hear one. Yeah, so, that's worse. For these kind of theoretical approaches that you can deal with typical methods of theoretical physics, and as has become clear already for those who saw the talk by Fate, when he asked questions like, how come or what do you have to do in order to a network has, how does a network solve the problem that its intrinsic chaotic dynamics deletes more information per unit time that it can transmit, that it's supposed to process. So that's an important question, and it's something we can treat with methods of nonlinear dynamics, as Fred showed. But so more generally, we've been studying dynamical problems, the dynamics of networks in the last 20 years or so, synchronization properties, influence of the topology of the network on the synchronization properties, and so on, or also spatially extended systems like the formation, pattern formation in the development of cortical maps, right? But so today, I want to show you a phenomenon that covers both, so neuronal systems and more generally is known in nonlinear dynamics, the phenomenon of self-organized criticality. And so I guess this is why the organizers have announced this talk as a general interest talk. And I see at least two general interest persons in the audience, and I'll try to do my best to make this into a general interest talk. So what I want to deal with is the occurrence of avalanche-like activity in neuronal networks and see how far we can go to understand their dynamics. Before I go on, I should mention my co-workers. That's Anna Levina, former grad student and Russian mathematician. I spent quite some time this morning to find a photograph of her where she's lying in the arms of Gauss, not Gauss, very Gauss, a statue of his in Göttingen after she got her PhD. Couldn't find it, unfortunately. And Michael Herrmann, who is now in Edinburgh. Okay, here's Peter, the take-home message, number one. Well, in case I don't get to the message at all, here's the take-home message. So we consider fully connected networks of integrated and fire neurons that show avalanches, as symbolized here, of firing. This phenomenon has been confirmed experimentally in, well, cultured and acute cortical slices, in hippocampal cultures, and awake monkeys. Beg your pardon? No, in this case, globally connected. No. I come to this when I introduce the model. Okay. We can get analytical expressions for the avalanche size distribution. They show inverse power laws. And it's been discussed that these critical avalanches might play a functional role. So for instance, that the critical state has optimal information storage and information transmission, or optimal sensitivity to external stimuli, like for instance, the maximum dynamic range. And all these properties are connected with the fact that these avalanches have scale-free properties. So you have avalanches on all scales. And so this is what has stimulated people to think that this could play such a functional role. Now, the second take-home message is that there are phase transitions, first and second order phase transitions, into this region of self-organized criticality. You'll see such cusp bifurcations, actually phase transitions, in this parameter space of, well, two coupling parameters, alpha and U0, where there is a coexistence of subcritical and critical states that go away in such a cusp. Okay, so that's what I want to transmit today. And I guess my APS battery is getting low. This is the advantage of going to the APS March meeting. You get such free pens that you can use as laser pointers if you don't have any other. No, works. Okay, self-organized criticality. What? Self-organized criticality. it's a concept that was introduced by Burbach, Chow Tang, and Kurt Wiesenfeld more than 20 years ago. They originally considered sand piles, idealized sand piles. We would throw sand randomly, and the sand pile would organize with a certain slope where avalanches would come down in all scale-free ways and so on. And they tried to explain one over F noise with this, and later they tried to explain complexity, the occurrence of complexity, and so on. And it worked best experimentally with Longkorn rice grains. That's why we have the rice here. These avalanches have a power law, inverse power law distribution. And the system has a critical state as an attractor. So like this critical slope. Our approach is somewhat in between, say, the bioengineering approach with many variables and many parameters, and the approach of Per Buck, who later wrote a book of somewhat more than 100 pages, which he entitled How Nature Works. Chow Tang was actually a postdoc here in this institute about 20 years ago. And he was a grad student of Komoto and Leo Kardanov, and worked with lots of people. I think he held in many different fields. He also has a paper with Boris Schramm, and I think was a postdoc of Jim Langer here when he was a director of the institute. And he's now at UCSF, and you wouldn't believe it. From this area of how nature works, he's now become the vice chair of the bioengineering department at UCSF. Zwei Seelen wohnen ach in meiner Brust. I can translate it. Okay, so much for the origins of this. And it has been speculated over the years that neural networks could also operate with self-organized criticality. But the ideas were mainly based, and the models were mainly based on the stick-slip models that you use for earthquakes and so on. So not really neuronal models. And this has changed in 2002, where the first really neuronal network was investigated that showed critical avalanches. And that was done by three of my former co-workers, Ulrich, Hermann, and Ernst, who considered a fully connected network of integrated and fire neurons here in one dimension, symbolically. Single parameter is the synaptic strength. And they have a slowly delivered external input that excites randomly on a slow time scale, picks randomly a unit that it can excite here, a neuron. There's a separation of these time scales. And, well, okay. So on the right-hand side, you see such a schematical avalanche. Occasionally, this external stimulus triggers an avalanche. So in the next time step, you will have two neurons that are active. And in the next time step, perhaps four, and so on. And then it stops. And so the size of the avalanche is the sum of all these firing events. So 1 plus 2 plus 4 equals 7 neurons would be the size of the avalanche in this case here. And so here's again such a schematical illustration of the avalanches. Okay, so that's a globally connected network, Peter. And excitatory. And in this case, one coupling parameter, alpha. They all have the same coupling, all to all connected. So they found a critical distribution, an inverse power law for precisely tuned connectivity parameters. That's shown here. Here's the distribution of the avalanche sizes. Here's the avalanche size. And here, its variation as a function of the parameter. It's called alpha zero here. So in this case, the same as alpha. It's the coupling parameter. And so there is one precisely tuned parameter where in this model here, 2002, where the size distribution is an inverse power law. And as you go away from this parameter, here slightly smaller than one, you find a subcritical behavior where it goes away from the power law, or a supercritical behavior where it also goes away from the power law. And the exponent is minus 3/2. So this is like a phase transition. And they derived an analytic expression for the avalanche size distribution, very lengthy combinatorial calculation. Now, this is definitely not self-organized criticality, because it's like a phase transition. There is a critical point, and at this critical point, you have the inverse power law behavior of the sizes of the avalanches, but not in a broader range. So that's not what you think of as self-organized criticality, as I said before, where you have a kind of an attractor that attracts the system into the critical state. Not in this model, no. So that's a historical introduction, right? This is not the work I want to present today. And it's, of course, a simple model.
An avalanche starts.
I can't hear you.
How does an avalanche start?
Well, you have external noise in the sense that you excite randomly a neuron, right? You pick.
The initial condition.
What?
If at each time you have external input coming in, the initial conditions are different.
Yes, I mean you excite randomly on a slow time scale a neuron. The neuron is picked randomly, and you don't repeat from zero, but I mean you have a state already, dynamical state, and then you pick, after a long time, you pick, you let the system pick randomly an external input that excites randomly a particular neuron, okay? Yeah, before it has entirely relaxed, but it's a long time scale. Now, naively, you could think, should explain this, how you understand this. Naively, you could think, if you think of a neuron that has a system with a threshold, and when the neuron, the membrane potential reaches the threshold, well, there's a breakdown and it fires and so on. Then you would think, if it doesn't get enough input, then it will never fire. If it gets input, and they are all to all connected, then it will everything will fire. So that's the naive picture, that you will get an avalanche that covers the whole system, all the whole network. If you are super threshold with your excitation, or if you're sub-threshold, you never fire. Okay, what happens is a little more sophisticated. Well, there is exactly one critical parameter value where it fires on all scales. That's the critical point. As you go above, there's a tendency for large avalanches to cover the whole system, right? This is this peak, for instance, here. And as you go below this coupling strength, then there's a tendency to have smaller avalanches, but not critical avalanches.
So what is the connection between the nodes? Equal connection, all to all?
Yes.
Equal?
Yeah, yeah. In this old model. And all excitatory and so on.
So I'm a little confused when you said there's an attractor, the critical state is an attractor. You're talking about the dynamics? It looks like you have to tune a particular parameter to get there. For other parameters, you don't get there.
Right, exactly. This is exactly the point. When I said an attractor, I didn't speak of the neural network here. I applied this in the context with the sand piles and so on that go into this particular slope. Here you will see how this comes about. This is actually the first half of part of my talk to show how you get self-organized criticality. As you noticed, this is not self-organized criticality. This is just a phase transition, one critical point. Self-organized criticality means you vary your parameters over a certain range, and you find this critical behavior, not at a critical point, but in a certain range of parameters. And that's what I want to transmit here, convey.
I'm just really confused about this. If you have every neuron connected to every neuron with weight alpha, when one neuron goes off, why doesn't everybody fire on the next?
That's exactly what I tried to answer in my remark before.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
Okay. What you're saying is either you get the whole network firing, right? If you're super threshold and the coupling is strong enough, right? So one neuron excites two and they excite three, four, and eight, and so on.
One neuron excites two, it's connected to everybody with the same weight.
Yeah.
So if it fires one of those neurons, why doesn't it fire everyone?
Okay, yeah. But let me I'm just repeating this once more.
Perhaps the answer is that when this neuron fires, the polarization of the postsynaptic neurons is not identical. They are on different parts of the outer. So this magic thing would be enough to make some of them fire, but not enough to make the other fire. So there is a non-homogeneous state, although the cathode is homogeneous. And how you go to that state, then you have to use an anti-system.
Okay, maybe I can give another answer. It's what I said. It's exactly what you expect naively, right? And I tried to explain this already once. So if this is too large, the coupling is too large, then you have a tendency that the whole network fires. Right? That's what you expect. If the coupling is too small, you have a tendency that nothing fires. What happens in this network is that there is a critical state, and actually, in the thermodynamic limit, some people claim that's unreasonable for neuronal systems, but it's the bioengineers that claim this. In the thermodynamic limit, n going to infinity, this limit is alpha equal 1. I mean, the critical coupling is at alpha equal 1. Keep it in mind. We need it later on when I come to my own topic. Alpha equal 1. Of course, the coupling is normalized by the number of neurons in the system, n. So at this critical coupling equal 1, you have this critical behavior tendency to get these avalanches on all scales. And below, there is a tendency, right, to have subcritical behavior. Now, this is this old work, and as Ken has noted, it is not self-organized criticality. And then, I'll come to this afterwards. Let me first show you some experiments. The experiments were done by, the first experiments were done by Becks and Plentz on so-called multi-electrode arrays. You saw one here. So this is such an array where you have neuronal cultures or slices. You see this, such an array that they use down here, 64 electrodes, not very many, but and they found these avalanches by some data analysis. Here you see such a actually an experimentally observed avalanches. So what they did, they used cortical slices, acute slices, and also cultured slices on this array. And they looked at these negative deflections of the local field potentials where you see several neurons firing. And they detected the firing events from these negative deflections. And then with some kind of data analysis, they extracted these avalanches. What they found is inverse power law distributions for these avalanche sizes. Exponent minus we have, the same as the one predicted in this model by Ulrich, Ernst, and Hermann. And it is kind of robust. So rather like self-organized criticality than a critical point. So after treating the network with chemicals, this criticality went away. Here the red curve. And after washing for 24 hours, it came back. No, this is the one here. So the dynamics is stable, was stable over many recordings and returned and so on. And they were obtained in many different cultures and slices. And so you didn't have to tune a parameter in order to find the phenomenon. So this looks like self-organized criticality in contrast to this phase transition criticality that we saw in this model before. Before I go on, I want to mention some other experiments. There have been much more sophisticated experiments in the meantime. Here's one with 512 electrode array. The array comes from Littke here at UCSE and Bex. It is published, unpublished work. And so much larger electrode array, they find a larger regime of the criticality. This is done on acute cortical slices. Then people here, this is the group of Torda in Italy, have applied spike sorting techniques and also got a much larger range of this critical behavior using dissociated hippocampal cultures. And there have been experiments done in the group of Plentz with Nicolelis on awake rhesus monkeys, 64 electrode array in M1. And they all showed this robust critical avalanches. So you suspect there is indeed some self-organized criticality going on. But the model so far didn't show this. It was just critical behavior. So then when I heard this talk given by Udo Ernst at one of our skiing seminars a long time ago, I had the gut feeling that if you used synaptic dynamics, which is kind of an adaptive mechanism, that this could give rise to self-organized criticality. Now, we already had very good introductions last week to this problem by Herbie and David Colom. So, and I guess I don't have to go into too many details on this, but let me just describe this intermediate description of synaptic dynamics. Now, Peter?
Oh, yeah, didn't Pepper Lawson Yang define self-organized criticality and measure it without the
gap? I didn't get the first part of your sentence. Well, you can go back to Hopfield and Hertz in the early 90s, where they predicted self-organized criticality, and even earlier to Günter Radons, who gave a talk at the German March meeting that Hertz listened to. So there is a long history, but the real neuronal systems, I think that started in 2002 with this work by Ulrich and colleagues. Oh, come on. We are on our way to more realistic systems, if you'll ever let me go there. So here's an idea. This is the more or less the formulation of Henry Markram and Misha Zodiks of dynamical synapses, depressing synapses, and later facilitating synapses. So let me first show you the experiment. You have a presynaptic excitation here, such a periodic spike train. And what is observed in experiments sometimes is that the response, the postsynaptic response, is weakened as the synapse is used by these spikes. So kind of fatigue. And this fatigue has been described mathematically by Michal Zodiks in such an equation. At least you can reduce it to such an equation. And I will tell those of you who are not familiar with this afterwards how to understand this. So the Jij is the coupling between the two neurons I and J. And so this is a dynamical variable which wants to relax to a stationary state J0. That's the same for all, but dynamically they can differ, of course. And it wants to relax with a rate 1 over tau J. And whenever, oh boy, whenever neuron J fires, then the coupling Jij is depressed by a certain ratio U times Jij. Okay, that, and this can describe this fatigue phenomenon. Here you see the model in comparison to the experiment. See the same thing for random spiking, presynaptic spiking, and it can describe this as well. Now, how to understand this? Well, most of the people in the program have seen this last week already. The synapses work by transmitting chemicals, transmitter molecules in these vesicles that open up. And so these vesicles have a finite amount of synaptic resources, these chemicals. And when this synapse has to spike, to do this too often, then it uses up its resources and weakens its strength, so it cannot transmit as many. So that's about the idea that's behind assuming such a description. Okay, now the idea was if we use this synaptic dynamics, dynamical couplings, can we find something like this self-organized criticality? And so here's the model. Here you see again the equation that you just saw. And here's the other equation that describes the network. A random excitation from the outside, right, which picks a particular neuron I. Tau S is a slow time scale. And here's the spiking. When J spikes, then the membrane potential of neuron I is increased by this amount here. Okay, and here's the decrease of the coupling. Oh yes, let me show the parameters. Alpha is the maximal synaptic strength, in this case here scaled. And U, as I mentioned, is the fixed, so far fixed usage of synaptic resources.
Sorry, what is psi of T?
Psi of T is a random variable that picks a certain neuron I randomly, which it wants to excite.
So
it's an external excitation.
It's a single neuron
label. Yeah. Yeah, imagine your rice pile or sand pile where you put a grain of sand or rice on a particular position randomly, that you pick randomly. It's the same idea. Okay. That's the question, leaky integrate and fire, or integrate and fire. Okay, now, yes, I'm giving you the answer. That's the difference between integrate and fire and leaky integrate and fire. Now, as a theoretical physicist, I don't have to tell you this, we can do everything analytically for the integrated firing neuron, so kind of conservative. It doesn't have the minus H is so the leaky term that you could put in here. But then we cannot treat this analytically. Now we've done simulations, of course, where we had such a term, and to some extent, up to 40 milliseconds or so, this shows the same self-organized criticality that I want to show you. But we cannot treat this analytically, this problem, if you have the leaky integrated fire. So this is just integrated fire. Yes. And I should mention there is a very recent paper by Ernst Niebuhr where he also treats the leaky integrated a leaky integrated fire network.
So there's okay. No other source of noise or variation in the membrane potentials of the neuron?
No.
And alpha is the same for every pair?
Yes. But of course, the actual momentary coupling JIJ can vary between for all of these. Okay, and now here's first the comparison of phenomenological comparison. Here I have the static synapses that you saw before, and here's the system with the depressing synapses. Size distribution as a function of this coupling parameter. And you see there's a broader range of parameters alpha where you find the critical behavior and supercritical and subcritical here. Now, looking at this more closely, you see it here, we determined the deviation from a power law, so just the error if you want, as a function of these coupling parameters for the static synapses and for the depressing synapses. And for the static synapses, as you see, there's essentially, and if you imagine you have a threshold where you say, okay, if it's our error is below this threshold, then I say it's critical, and it's above, so it's no longer critical, then you see that there is a very one critical point here, parameter alpha, where you have critical behavior, an inverse power law. And whereas for our depressing synapses, we have a broader region of alpha values where a critical region where we find an inverse power law behavior. And I actually want to show you afterwards. We can show this analytically that this region widens and actually becomes infinite in the thermodynamic limit. Yeah.
Oh. These are not simulations on the right, right? Because you said you could solve the problem analytically.
Yes, I'm coming to, I hope I can come to this.
But are these results are analytical results?
Yes.
Correct. Yeah. So,
I mean, this here is analytical, this was already analytical results to show the...
The one with the present synapses is analytical.
So. Yes.
So in an analytic model where you are not constrained by the size of the system on which you are doing the simulation, you get the power law for a decade and a half, not even 2 decades, mm-hmm. and you're happy to think that this is a critical phenomenon?
In an analytic system? I mean, I can look at the... Come on. People let me go so far, I will show that you can treat the thermodynamic limit. And you can show this analytically, the scaling behavior in the thermodynamic limit, and not only over one decade. I mean, this is still...
Let me ask a question if I'm right.
Yes.
Same question. Regarding the
go to the next slide, go back to you.
Okay.
So from the point of view of physics, get on neuroscience. Yes. Is there one value of alpha at which there's scaling for infinite size systems, or is there a continuous range of alpha?
Are you talking about
this
or this?
Both. On the left, you said there's only one point on the bottom.
Okay.
On the right, it also looks like there's only one point on the bottom. It just looks like it's wider.
Yeah. So I will show.
Oh,
at the bottom. Yeah. No, I will show. Okay. Okay. So the answer will be, but it comes later. For this case, in this case, I can give it here. In the thermodynamic limit, I actually said it before, the critical point is alpha equal 1 in the thermodynamic limit. So this shifts upwards to alpha equal 1. In this case, you have a finite region. And it becomes infinite in the thermodynamic limit for alpha equal 1 up to whatever coupling parameter you want. And that can be easily seen, well, easily perhaps not, but theoretically. Okay, so the critical region. Now, as you look at varying, increasing sizes, you see already well, it gets somewhat larger here, but okay. Now, I'd like to describe the theoretical approach.
So, all entire networks are not dependent on the same grand area.
I can't understand you here.
All entire networks.
Yes.
You really don't see them in the right area.
Yeah.
So, what is this going to tell us about how the brain?
Yeah, maybe you should ask this question in the end. You have to start somewhere. So the people started using static synapses. Now we are improving this to more realistic synapses. And of course, you have to look at networks that are not globally connected, but sparse networks and so on. This is all on our way. But here I'm trying to present you what we have done so far. Okay. I want to describe you a mean field theory to get these analytic results. Now imagine these are globally connected networks, extremely high connectivity, and mean field theory becomes exact, of course, in the thermodynamic limit anyhow. But it's extremely accurate, of course, also for networks of sizes 100 or 500. What we're dealing with are two quantities. That's the average interspike interval, delta ISI, time averaged. And you see it exists. Here is the distribution of these interspike intervals. For different coupling parameters alpha, well behaved, and we're using this as one quantity in our mean field theory. Here's the average synaptic efficacy. So this variable U is constant in this case, Jij, time average just before the spike. And you also see here there's a well behaved distribution of these. U times J, and also the mean exists. That's of course numerical. Now what we are doing is we are calculating the average synaptic coupling by assuming that neurons fire with a mean rate, delta ISI. And we calculate the delta ISI by assuming that all neurons have a mean coupling strength. That's the idea of mean field theory. And we can calculate this the mean coupling strength, well, if we assume such a, it's actually a periodic spiking of the network with this average rate delta ISI. And this can be calculated, as you see here. It's an as the time interval between, well, you see it afterwards, I'll show it. So there are these two functions that we calculate, and at stationarity, of course, the two functions must be consistent. So like in mean field theory, we determine, you can do it graphically, and that's shown on the next transparency. Here you see the average coupling increases as a function of the interspike interval. So as the spiking becomes slower, the synapses have more time to recover. So the synapses become larger. So the average coupling is larger. And the and this other function delta ISI is shown as a function of the mean coupling, is this red line here. And you see that for a given coupling strength, you find one solution. These are for different coupling strength here, one solution. The solutions, this is the analytic work here, the intersections are the analytic solutions. I'll show you the simulation results. Those are the stars here, and so they agree quite well with the analytic results. And now here comes the question, thermodynamic limit. This is more or less the right, left-hand side and right-hand side of these, of this equation down here. All right. Where we look for consistent solutions. You can assume various scaling behaviors for the interspike interval. N to the power 1 plus epsilon and so on. And you will see that the left and right hand side cannot be brought into consistent behavior for n going to infinity. So it's 0 or diverges to minus infinity. So all this does not lead to a solution, except the two last cases, delta ISI scaling as n to the 1 minus epsilon or scaling linearly in n. Then we can show that the left-hand side goes to alpha and the right-hand side to 1. So this is consistent for the case alpha equal 1. And we can show that the mean coupling U times Jij goes to 1 in this case. And that's the critical coupling for the static synapses. It's something we get some understanding on how the self-organization actually functions. And here, for the scaling linearly in n, this is also consistent if alpha is larger than 1, and we can calculate this factor c here, and show that also the average, the mean coupling ujij goes to 1 in this case. So from this type of scaling argument, we see that in the thermodynamic limit, the critical region goes from alpha equal 1 to alpha equal infinity. Because the mean coupling goes to 1, and this is the critical point of the static synapses. Now let me resume. This adaptive system with dynamical synapses by its mean field behavior in the thermodynamic limit approaches a state where the synapses adapt, the synapses adapt dynamically, they are depressed, right? If the neuron, presynaptic neurons fire, they use up the resources. You start perhaps with alpha, with a larger alpha, but the actual coupling UJIJ is much smaller because JIJ is depressed. And so the JIJ, the average JIJ, is depressed, adapted down to the value 1. And that's the critical point of the static synapses. And this is how self-organized criticality works in this case. What is? Nu is a, I think it's a factor between the different time scales. Okay, now I hope this answers your question. Okay. Maybe I should go a little faster, show that you can also treat the finite size scaling when you look at this inverse power law behavior for different sizes of networks. You get the minus 3/2 power here and this crossover. And doing the usual tricks with the scaling ansatz as a function of network size L and system size N, and using what we know about the critical behavior here, there's this inverse power law exponent for minus 3/2. Also analytically, we can compute the average size, of course, for finite N, average size of the avalanches. And then equating all this, it's what people have done in Seattle, for instance, and other places for 30 years. So you can get out the exponents here, the beta and the nu that you use in this ansatz by equating this, gauging it with these properties here. I'm sorry, I'm running out of battery. And then we can show that nu is equal 1 and beta is minus 3/2. Okay. Now, if you and the test for this scaling ansatz, of course, the so-called data collapse. If you plot this distribution not as a function of L but as a function of L over this power of n, and you multiply this by n to the power of beta, and that's done here. Okay. Multiplied, and here L divided by N, the first power, and then you see the data collapse, all these curves fall on the same curve. So that's now the behavior as a function of L and N. And let me come to the last part. Now, we've considered also not only depressing synapses, but also facilitating synapses, as is known since same year here. This can be described by two equations, in addition to our third equation for the network. So it's been observed that synapses, when they are used repeatedly. Not only do they depress, but they can also facilitate. And the usual explanation for this is that the calcium that's floating around that is needed for synaptic release. And if there's also already calcium from a previous release, then it facilitates the successive release. And so it's an synapses tend to increase their rate. And so this is described in by these two equations. The first equation is the same that we had before, but now U is a dynamical variable. The amount of synaptic resources that is used in a particular synaptic event. And so U wants to get to its stationary state U0 with a relaxation rate 1 over tau U. And it increases at every spiking event. Now we're using this in the same model. We have these two time constants. We've studied this for very and numerically for different constants. Here we use the two time constants identical. Now what we had before for the static synapses, for the depressing synapses, will now change into a behavior that you see here. For the facilitatory synapses, the avalanche size distribution shows critical behavior in this red regime. It is shown only as a function of this coupling parameter alpha. There's another parameter, U0. Supercritical and subcritical behavior. But what happens here is this looks like a first order phase transition, where abruptly this distribution changes from super subcritical to critical. And again, we've done this in a mean field theory. Here are the two equations. There is a third equation that's identical with the previous model for the membrane potential. Again, we calculate the interspike interval, the average, and the synaptic strength, their averages, and we evaluate the self-consistency equation where the average uij, jij averaged must be a consistent function of itself. And now uij is also time dependent and can vary, of course, momentarily for different ij, right? Different synapses. Even if the alpha is one parameter. I remind you how the graphical solution of the problem looked before. Monotonous increase for the jij as a function of the delta ISI. But here what we, okay, that was what we had before. But here what we find is a non-monotonous behavior of this blue function. And so in certain cases, like the one down here, again for different values of alpha coupling. So in one case, you only have one solution, one intersection with the red curve. Up here, you also have only one intersection with the blue curve. But there are intermediate values of alpha where you can have three intersections, okay? So three solutions. I will show this in the next transparency. Okay. Here you see there's only one solution. Here there's also one solution. But in between, there's a case where you can have three solutions, three intersections. What you see here is the delta ISI, of course, averaged, and the average coupling strength. That's the mean field treatment. And what you see here is this behavior of the average coupling strength as a function of the parameter alpha. There's this other parameter U0, which I'm not considering here at present, but afterwards. So as you vary the alpha, you get from this, well, you saw it on the previous transparency, I should go back, right? As you vary the parameter alpha, you get from this regime with one solution to three solutions to one solution again. Okay, so that's shown on the alpha axis now here. one solution, and in between you have three solutions. And as a function of alpha, they run like this. So there is a critical point, alpha lower C, where the three solutions start. And there is another critical point, alpha C, upper C, where the it ends. Now, the upper solution is a critical scaling solution, inverse power laws. And the lower one is the subcritical, in green. And this third solution in the middle is unstable as usually. And in a stochastic system, you don't see it. It doesn't show up. Now, if you have such an S-shaped bifurcation diagram, then you expect hysteresis, right? If you go up here, you would continue on the subcritical and eventually jump to the critical behavior, and vice versa. So do we see such a hysteresis? Well, that's the numerical results. You see it. As you go up, that's the green curves, there's a persistence of the supercritical behavior. And as you go down in alpha, there's a persistence of the critical behavior. So there's a region where you have both. Here again, as a function of alpha, the overlapping region of critical and subcritical behavior that's taken for a particular length, L equal 40, size. Now again, thermodynamic limit, as before, we have to look at the scaling behavior of the left-hand side and the right-hand side. And a solution exists only if the mean interspark interval behaves linearly in the system size. And it can be shown that a solution exists only for alpha larger than the square root, and in all that's shown here. Okay. Now here's the alpha, and here's the other parameter U0, related to the facilitation. So in the thermodynamic limit, you have a solution only above this dashed line. And in all cases where a solution exists, the average coupling strength is 1, as before. So that shows again how the critical region is widened. So taking alphas in a broad range, nevertheless, it behaves as if it had static synapses at the that are at the critical value equal 1. So this corresponds to the critical state. Now, for finite system sizes and increasing system sizes, you see this cusp-like behavior. So that's the region where you have three coexisting states, and they end in this cusp, where you, well, here you have a first-order phase transition, and they end in a second-order phase transition. So within this cusp, you have three solutions. Below, only supercritical, subcritical behavior. In here, subcritical and critical behavior. And here you have a smooth transition from first, second-order phase transition. Okay, and in the thermodynamic limit, this cusp ends at U0 equal 0.5. Now, after slightly more than an hour, I get to my summary. And maybe I should answer Peter's question, what is it good for? Well, first of all, you have to do more work to get to more realistic cases. Of course, more realistic network topologies. That's what we are doing. But is this something that you can observe in experiment? And well, I should say here. Well, maybe one more. This is a switching phenomenon. Right? You can the network can switch from a critical state to a subcritical state and vice versa. And first of all, this is always useful since we know since the von Neumann computer that you can use such hysteretic behavior for switching. And also, I mean, the cortex might use such a phenomenon for some usefulness of switching. So that's the same type of argument as what the other people have thought on information transmission and so on. But also it's something that you could verify experimentally. Let me go back one point. Imagine you have this network excited from some other area with a synchronized input. If the synchronized input is strong enough, then you can induce such a switching from this to that, to a critical state. So you could modulate your system so as to have a better optimized response to external stimuli, or to increase the dynamic range of the system, because the upper state has an optimized dynamic range, the subcritical state doesn't. So this might be used by a neuronal network, a biological network. We have to figure out. But that could be a function. And this could also be tested, of course, experimentally, whether you can switch, a hippocampal culture from a subcritical behavior to a supercritical behavior. And then maybe I should resume and show you my summary. Dynamical synapses provide the network with robust self-organized critical behavior. For facilitatory synapses, we find first and second order phase transitions that lead into the self-organized critical state. So that's a new phenomenon for the self-organized criticality. As far as we know, we haven't found any system in the literature that shows such a sulfur squiggly behavior associated with phase transitions. These phase transitions are connected by a cusp bifurcation, and we have this switching between these two phases that we could trigger from the outside. Now, thank you for your attention. This laser pointer fatigue here. No, in the thermodynamic limit, you also have this. You have this coexistence region here. It's the thermodynamic limit is this dashed cusp. This here. Yeah, that's the mean coupling strength that tunes itself to this critical point. Yeah, we use them identical, but we, of course, we checked simulations with different values of tau j and tau u. I mean, I mean, the opposite is easier to follow. If you have a longer delta ISI, right, then synaptic resources can recover better, and you get a higher JIJ. And vice versa, there is also the dependence on of delta ISI on JIJ.
So I think it's a question more about the original model. So the question is, what picked delta ISI in the original model? It was some delta ISI problem in the critical state for the original model.
Yeah.
What picked that? I already didn't see what Einstein was in the original model. So something like the typical interspike interval was in the original model. I don't see what it is, because in this model it's clear what it is. It's the condition that alpha equal 1, not to alpha f equal 1.
I have to look it up.
No, I have another question. Whether maybe it's like No, so in the original model, right, so the time constant is where, but the time constant that's there is basically the time constant for the inputs. So that determines the but to understand sort of the model, right, so if I understand it correctly, actually have, so essentially you have three time constants, right? You have some time constant with which the input change picks some neuron, and you have a time constant for, or in other words, the time constant for the interavalanche interval. Then you have a time constant for the synapses, and you have a membrane time constant. Now, if I understand it correctly, so for the model, in the model you basically assume that the avalanche interval is smaller than the synaptic time constant, which is smaller than the membrane time constant. So my question is basically, what does this have to do with biology? Right? Because in biology, you have a membrane time constant, which is then 20 milliseconds, you have a synaptic time constant, which is several hundred, the synaptic recovery, which is several hundred milliseconds, and bursts which occur, or the avalanches which occur on with delays of many seconds. So it seems to me that the model is interesting, but it doesn't really necessarily have anything to do with biology. To get sort of this self-organized criticality, you need to have some time constant which is long, or at least of the same order as the time constant between the avalanches.
It's a
single spike. The rows will have small time.
Yeah, so it's a single spike, but then
some of the short countries more short time.
Yeah, well, in the experiments, they speak of an avalanche when they have three spiking events,
right.
Not less.
Things continue to be in an avalanche if there is not a gap of more than several milliseconds. But so if you actually look at the records, you see an avalanche, then nothing for all. Almost a second or more than a second, and then you get another avalanche. It seems to me that some sort of the.
But that's what's done in the model also. I mean. The old authors, and we assume a slow time scale of excitation. So. And you pick on a very slow time scale, you excite randomly from a neuron from the outside.
So in this model, there is no spontaneous activity. Every now and then, after another chance, you pick one neuron
and it's
different.
Well, in the extreme, yes.
But in the extreme, right, you will have that, so everything is recovered. After we have an avalanche, then nothing. So
but that's only the extreme. I mean,
all the synapses have recovered.
Yeah, but it's. Yeah, but it's the extreme. I mean, they and we also consider the case where you just have a slow time scale of external stimuli, but not an infinite time scale.
Is of the same order as the is let's say the same as the synaptic time constant. Then you can rescale down your synapses by e to the minus one. So to get something which is where you can have essentially infinite alpha, you need to have that the time between avalanches is smaller than
You mean to extend your range of self-organized criticality to alpha going to infinity, Then, of course, yeah. But maybe you don't need alpha going to infinity, but only alpha in a finite range.
Even if you have avalanches occurring once every second, right, which is a lot compared to what you see in experiments. Right, so once every second, then you have a synaptic, well, okay, let's be generous, you have a synaptic time constant impression time constant of 500 milliseconds. Right, so then your avalanches occur, so you can only descale.
Yeah. Okay, we leave this question to the bioengineers.
Yeah, no, so the point of my feeling is that you're working in sort of the wrong limit. I mean, I think there's totally different.
Okay. There is an old tradition. You know this, the drunken who is looking for his keys. Okay, I don't have to repeat this. Yeah, but we have different lanterns, and we can look under various lanterns. Another one is to forget about dynamical synapses and to just look at the origin of self-organized criticality in the structure of the topology of the networks, for instance. So there are various approaches, and this is just one of them.